Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. After three terms as chair of Mecklenburg County Commission, George Dunlap decided not to run for another term in that position, and that left the door open for new leadership. Mark Jarrell chose to walk through that door on County Commission since 2018, representing District 4. Fellow commissioners agreed unanimously that he should be the new chairman. He has said he wants to focus on improving equity and affordability, ensuring resources are available for the county's most vulnerable citizens. And we're going to get his thoughts on that and on the prospect of another property tax hike, our transit plans, the Brooklyn Village project, and more as Mark Jarrell joins us for the hour. And he has done the impossible. He's gotten me to do this from WFAE Studios. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
It was a good drive-in. We should have carpooled.
We should have.
Well, congratulations on a unanimous decision by your fellow commissioners to name you the chair. But I have to ask, because this is none of these jobs are easy and none of these jobs are always pleasant. Why did you want it?
Well, I think when I look at my experience, well, first of all, George was tired. I think George had enough. You know, you're dealing with eight people, eight different thoughts about multiple issues. But I think when I looked at it, you look at the challenges that are there. I think it's incumbent upon people to step up, try to stand in the gap. And, you know, George did a phenomenal job of trying to prepare us and prepare us for his departure. But also, you know, I raised my hand and said, hey, I'd be interested in trying to fill your shoes. And he did a phenomenal job of preparing me for that.
You know, he's been in the game for a very long time in very various different positions. And many people in county government and city government have done the same thing. What is it that drives people, ordinary citizens, mm-hmm. to step up and say, I will shoulder this for a year or two or three or six or ten or whatever it may be? Because it's a lot of extra work, and it's part-time, and you're not well paid. So why?
Passion for people. People want to make a difference. So anybody that you see sitting in these seats as electeds, they want to make a change. I can tell you from our board specifically, my eight other colleagues, they are passionate. They're working. Right now, I guarantee you, all of them are on their second meeting. They're following up on constituent calls. They're going to not end their day until 9 o'clock tonight. And to your point, they're part-time. They do that 7 days a week for the most part. They're sacrificing. You know, and I'll tell you, most of us do this work. We're going to make the sacrifices because we believe that the future can be bright. We want to set the conditions for the future generations and leave this place better than what we found it. And that's just, Mike, that's really... It's a constant itch. It's hard to scratch. You just, you know, you make strides and you progress, but it's never enough. And so there's just a passion for people and trying to improve their lives.
Do you find people believe that when you say it, or are they cynical about government because of what's been happening at the national level, or is it because local government is what really affects people's lives? What they do in Washington affects all of us to a degree, but you pave the roads, not the county, but the county does. To a certain degree. You take care of public health. You fund the schools. This is where the rubber meets the road.
Absolutely. I think people are cynical. What happens at the federal level, I think, does trickle down to a degree. You know, people are skeptical. When I say that, it sounds like a cliche. I know it does. But the benefit that I have is I'm behind the scenes. I see how people are working. I see the sacrifices that they make. I would tell you this, if you would ask the families of my colleagues, do they really believe the statement that I just made? I guarantee you, you know, they would say absolutely. And I think there are, and it, you know, it's not just electeds. We have a tremendous amount of people
that are working in the nonprofit space, at staff, county staff. You know, we have 6,000 people that get up every day that do this work of helping people. So commissioners are not doing it alone. On the city side, same thing. CMS, same thing. So there are people that are passionate about helping and making sure that there's progress and setting the conditions for the future.
So you, Mark Jarrell, are the chair of the Mecklenburg County Commission. Tell me what the chair is responsible for, because you were District 4, you still are the District 4 representative.
District 4.
But before you were just the District 4 representative, which is the east part of Charlotte. I don't mean just.
I was going to say just.
Well, I mean, that was your responsibility. Those were your constituents. Right. Now your constituency is the entire county and the board itself. So tell me what the chair, how the chair functions.
Well, Let me just say this. All of us as commissioners, whether we're district or at large, you still have a responsibility for our decisions are going to impact the entire county. So you do have to have that district lens, but you're going to have that comprehensive view as well. But as chair, you know, one of the things that one of the main things you are representing Mecklenburg County. You are constantly advocating for Mecklenburg County and its residents. And so that plays out in our policy and our initiatives. You're facilitating meetings. Obviously, if there's, you have to do an emergency declaration, but it really is representation, it's advocacy, the facilitation, and really making sure that the vision is implemented. So our board priorities, making sure that that's implemented, that's communicated, and that we have the right outcomes. And so it's sort of leading that effort.
Mr. Dunlop, your predecessor, could get pretty prickly from time to time, and he wasn't afraid to speak his mind.
No.
Let's put it that way. And it would sometimes get contentious. Ben, there was this little period where he and the school board got into it. How would you describe your leadership style and how things will be different under your leadership than they were under his? And I don't mean to denigrate his leadership in any way. I'm just saying that yours is different. You're you. You're not him.
It is different. You know, I still say, and I want to be clear, I say this everywhere I go, George is the greatest chair we've had in Mecklenburg County. I believe that unequivocally. What he did to lead us through the pandemic, to navigate a board, there were four new people that came on the board in 2018. Mm-hmm. We had a different style, a different approach. Then we hit the pandemic, and you know he led us through some challenging times with CMS. To your point, for me, there is a difference in style. Obviously, I don't have the same level of experience, but you know I'm a collaborative person. I don't necessarily care where good ideas come from. I want to hear from everyone. I want us to work as a team as much as possible. And I really believe that's the way to achieve and optimize, maximize outcomes.
The people in District 4 probably know you because they've elected you than once. But the rest of the county may not. So who is Mark Jarrell? What's your background? What brought you here? What did you do before? And what are you doing now? Because it's part-time as a county commissioner.
Well, we run a small business. We've got a speech therapy company, my sister and I. So I work for my little sister. And that's interesting. But I run that business and been living in District 4 forever and married with two children. But I'm someone who ran campaigns previously. I worked with a lot of elected officials, either consulting or as a campaign manager. I've volunteered. I've been active in the community, whether it's Black Political Caucus and other areas. And just someone who has always wanted to be able to connect my passion for people, but I wanted it to play out in policy. There's only so much advocacy that you can do. And so when I thought about making this jump to the elected space, it was really saying, hey, listen, you've got to take this passion that you have and translate it into different initiatives, into different policy, so that we can really move the ball and move the needle.
So the word passion has come up a number of times in this conversation.
Sure.
I know that one of your passions is the opportunity to, this is a quote, the opportunity to provide systems that will allow for economic mobility. How can the county commission work toward that end?
Well, there's a few different ways that we can do that. One, I'm not doing it in isolation. So when you look at what my colleagues have advocated for, you take Commissioner Griffin, who's on the board now, and you look at him trying to adapt a new MWSBE policy.
MWSB is what?
Minority Women Small Business Enterprises. Okay. So that's providing access and opportunity to small businesses and minority-owned businesses so that these are folks that are going to create jobs for us and be able to pay livable wages and to be able to allow folks to purchase homes and different things of that nature. When you look at other initiatives that we have, providing, when I say systems, providing reasonable ways for us to assist people in property taxes. It's really difficult. It's really hard if you're on a fixed income to live in Mecklenburg County. You can be a homeowner, and a lot of times there's not mechanisms at the state level. So we're looking at different ways to provide assistance and help. Education is the key to economic and upward mobility. When you think about it, it's the foundation. So having great partners like Chairwoman Stephanie Sneed on the school board and you know, economic development, which is a new priority for us. This is an opportunity for us to incorporate workforce development into education and permeate and really give us a lift in so many areas that we want to help people. And you know, so there are different things that we can do at the county, but it really takes collaboration with all the entities that I named, with the city, with CMS, with the state, and to a large extent at the federal level as well.
Everything you just talked about costs money, from education on down to helping people lift their lives up and giving them opportunities for jobs. It all costs money. And since you and others on the commission are concerned about affordability, keeping the city and the county affordable for people to live in, and protecting the most vulnerable people among us, who are obviously impacted by a lack of economic opportunity, let's talk about how we fund all that, and we fund it through taxes. We had Harry Jones, the former county manager, sat in that chair on more than one occasion, more than five occasions, and said, taxes equal services. No taxes, no services. And we're learning that to be a fact because we've just gone through a property tax increase last year, and you're considering one. Now, the city also raised property taxes last year, and they're saying they're not doing it now. But last year, when County Manager Dina DiOrio presented the budget to you folks, she told you, you guys said, hold the brake, put the brakes on.
We did.
And she said, well, this is not going to be enough. We're going to have to come back to the well. Are you coming back to the well this time?
We're considering. We have to consider it. This is the way this works, Mike. We have to look at the needs of the community. We have to meet those needs. Unfortunately, government only has a couple of mechanisms, taxes and fees. But we have to put all options on the table. I mean, that's just a fact of the matter. I think, former manager Harry Jones was absolutely right. You know, but one of the things that this board does, and again, I just can't stress this enough, we have individuals that sit on this board that are going to do everything, and not just people on the board, our staff as well, that are going to do everything humanly possible to mitigate the adverse impact to our residents.
We'll come back and talk more about that because this is something that's going to happen, and we have to explain why it has to happen and why we have to keep doing it. I mean, growth is supposed to be good, and we're growing, but it's costing us. It's not paying us. We'll find out why in a moment. Charlotte Talks with Mark Jarrell in a moment on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks here on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Mark Jarrell is with us. He is the chair of the Mecklenburg County Commission, voted in unanimously in December for that role after having been on the County Commission since 2018, representing District 4. We were talking just before the break about the prospect of another increase in Mecklenburg County property taxes, because last year you put the brakes on what I think Dina DiOrio, the county manager, was recommending, trying to keep things low, knowing that right. The city, too, was considering a tax increase, which they did pass. And now it's apparent that you may need to come back to the well. Was it wise then to defer it, or would it have been better just to say, let's bite the whole apple and be done with it last time?
I think that's a fair question. I think when, you know, we're making decisions in real time, so we're looking at the impact that's going to, how it's going to impact our most vulnerable. At the time when we were looking at that, understanding that what the city was going to do, we wanted to really minimize that impact to our most vulnerable. So if we would have come on top of that, it would have been tough for a lot of our residents who are struggling.
But what's different today?
Well, today we've seen a slowdown in growth. During our retreat, we found out that there was a slowdown in growth, and then our needs have certainly increased. I mean, prices are rising, costs are rising everywhere. And so when that creates that deficit, we've got to find a way to make it up. But let me tell you what we did during the retreat. We actually tasked the manager and staff to go back to figure out where can we find some savings. Yeah. You know, they've done that historically anyway, but now we're asking them to take a deeper dive on behalf of our residents to see, okay, where can we cut? Where can we make up some of this delta?
But my question, what makes things different today was in reference to the most needy among us who would have been negatively impacted beyond what you felt they should be impacted by a complete tax increase last right. time. So now you're coming back and saying, well, we got to go up again. What has changed? Eggs are almost $5 a carton. So they weren't $5 a carton.
Yeah, but the needs have changed in where, I mean, our needs.
But how have their circumstances changed, if they have changed, and won't they be just as affected this time as they would have been last time? That's my question.
Yeah, and again, I think it's a fair question. One of the things, though, when you look at this, the mechanisms that we have in place, such as when you look at property owners. And so we've tried to implement an initiative called the Homes Program to help offset some of those, provide a grant to offset some of those property taxes. So we're doing everything that we can to mitigate that impact. At the time, it was really important for us, and I'm proud of the board, the way that we stepped up to say, listen, now is not the right time. We knew that we would have to revisit it. And we're going to do everything that we can to mitigate it.
You said that the county is in, quote, a belt-tightening spot this fiscal year and the upcoming fiscal year. If you kept tightening the belt, what would be the result? How would county services be impacted? What would citizens notice as you tighten that belt that they might not like?
Well, the needs of our residents are always going to be met. They won't see it. What that means is those are initiatives. So as commissioners, we have initiatives that are our passion. When you look at economic development for some, you look at other areas that we're passionate about, we have initiatives that we've been able to start. We probably won't be able to fund those initiatives at the same levels that we have in the past. But critical services are always going to be met. That's going to be our number one goal. We're going to make sure critical services, service delivery for our residents are met. But those other initiatives that we've had, we'll have to take a look at those and probably not fund those, be able to fund those at the levels that they've been funded over the last five fiscal years.
For the past 200-some years, we have lived in a representative democracy where we elect people to represent our interests and do things for us in our interests. And we've been talking about the passion of people on county commission and their individual passions and what they want to achieve on commission. How does that match up, and how do you determine what matches up with your constituents' passions? What have you heard from constituents about the prospect of raising taxes? What have you heard from them about what they'd like to see you achieve? Not you personally, but the board.
The board, sure. Well, I mean, constituents are always concerned when there's this swirl in the atmosphere around potential tax increases. Mm-hmm. We're not there yet, but you know, one of the things our constituents are concerned about, and you hear, so we provide surveys to the community. We're constantly trying to touch and figure out exactly what's important to the community. The community tells us, and they've told us repeatedly, education is important, housing is important, park and rec and environmental stewardship are important to them. You know, health and human services, public health, those areas are critical, and they are what's in the wheelhouse of the county. And so when you look at the priorities that we set, they align to the elements that the community is telling us.
You have said, I'm going to back up here. Mecklenburg County is expecting revenues to grow, I think, by $49.2 million next year.
Yes.
But you see a need for $61.9 million. There's a gap. What's the reason for the shortfall?
Well, I think it's just the reason is a slowdown in growth. We've seen growth at really facilitated rates over time, and now there was just a slowdown. So the burden has really shifted. We've seen a decrease in our commercial market values have gone down, which has really impacted and shifted the burden to our residents and that on the residential side. And so that burden shift on the residential side has outpaced the commercial side.
We have talked about this on this program in the past, but for those people who may not have listened or don't understand what you're saying, is that because of the pandemic, a lot of things changed in the business world. People don't go to work anymore. I mean, we have a lot of real estate downtown that is sitting empty and vacant. And the tax value of all that and the tax income coming from that, where as businesses shutter and don't need all that space, has shifted the property tax burden from the commercial space to residents. Somebody has
That's
to foot
right.
the bill. So when you talk about growth slowing, it's business growth. It's not the fact that people are not still moving here in droves.
People are moving here in droves, but it's the business. We're seeing the commercial side is really, really impacting us differently than what we've seen in the past.
Wow. Is this temporary, do you think, or is this something that is this a new paradigm?
Well, we're gonna have to deal with? You know, I would say that anytime we look at economic conditions, it's cyclical. I think we've seen some indicators that that's changing. Mm-hmm. And there's some, you know, a positive outlook on the horizon. But right now, in the short term, this is what we're dealing with. Yeah. And so we're going to have to adjust to it. But we always have our eye on the future as well. So, you know, we don't just want to be overreactive at any given point in time.
So more people are moving here, needing more services, needing the roads to be repaired, needing water and sewer to work, needing trash pickup, et cetera, needing health services. All of that's happening, even as the burden is being shifted to residents as opposed to away from businesses. And it's all happening at the same time that in Washington, they are taking a machete to the federal government and to funding programs, some of which will continue to exist because of court intervention. Others, we don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty out there, and a lot of that money filters down to cities and towns and counties. How concerned are you that the funding that you get from the federal government, the funding that CMS gets from the federal government, is going to disappear or evaporate, and you're going to have to fill the gap?
I'm very concerned about that. I think we as a community have to be concerned about that. You said it very well when you said uncertainty. There's a ton of uncertainty. There's mixed messages coming out of Washington. We know that we have a tremendous amount of people in the county that need those services. They're critical services. We do rely on elements of federal funding. They rely on that. And I'll tell you what's interesting right now, since FY20 to FY25, we have a funding gap, even as it relates to funding from the state. When you look at the cumulative totals there, with certain elements, including education, the courts, and other areas, we've made up, we as Mecklenburg County residents have made up $2.5 billion in just from fiscal year 2020 to FY25. So when you couple that with what potentially could happen on the federal level, that it would hurt our community. So we're going to continue to advocate.
Well, Donald Trump has tried to halt tens of millions of dollars in federal grants that our state's schools have been using to recruit and train teachers. Last week, the U.S. Department of Education, which may soon not exist, terminated more than $600 million in federal grants because the administration alleged the money was being used to train teachers in, these are their words, divisive ideologies. The Charlotte Observer reported on Friday that, effective immediately, CMS lost three grants totaling over $5 million, including one grant partially funded for an advanced teacher training program. Our public schools, by all measures, including a court decision, the Leandro decision, years ago, 20 years ago or more, are chronically underfunded, according to all measures. The state doesn't seem to respond to that. Now we're looking at this. How impacted will Mecklenburg County and or CMS be should federal funding, like what we just talked about, be reduced or disappear?
Yeah, well, certainly will be. They'll be impacted. And it's really unfortunate that we would be having a discussion about cutting funding as it relates to education. On a personal level, I just don't know what that says about our society. When you look at the disparities that already exist, people that don't have access to a quality education, when the quality of your education is determined by your zip code, and we would think we would not have the wherewithal to be able to say that this is a critical need. This is something as a society, just as human beings, it should be important to us. It's a sad commentary on our society.
The county steps in to a great degree and supplements the funding that goes to Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, and some of that supplement is necessary because of a lack of state funding. State legislators, Republican state legislators, would agree with you that you should not, your education should not be determined by your zip code. And so they've expanded the Opportunity Scholarship Program, which are designed to allow any child to take money that they will give them to go to a private school. And they call this the school of their choice. They call it choice. Trouble is, you cannot go to the school of your choice if you don't have economic means, because chances are those scholarships will not pay the full freight of most private educations. It's not choice because private schools don't have to take everybody who applies. It's not choice because they don't have to supply transportation and they don't have to supply special education, which would eliminate those schools for a lot of children and a lot of parents. This means overall, however, less money for the public schools, and the people who stay in those public schools, because of all the things I just talked about, are going to be the poorest. What does that mean for education, for the public schools, and for the county's need to step up and backfill with even more money?
Well, I think what it says to a lot of folks in the community is that there are certain people that don't care about our most vulnerable, don't care about opportunities for our most vulnerable. And to think that the county could continue to step up at the rate that we've been doing it, I mean, that's it's not a sustainable run rate, Mike. It's just we cannot continue to fill that gap the way that we've been doing it. It's not fair to the residents of Mecklenburg County. It's not fair to have concentrated poverty, poverty just concentrated in our school system like that. It's not what we want for our community. And so this, it's a crisis for our community. It's a crisis for the state, and frankly, it's a crisis for the country.
Donald Trump has removed diversity, equity, inclusion from the federal government. He's mandated that it go away, and the military. Two of your key areas of concerns are equity
absolutely,
and affordability. Starting with equity, it's been a focus of yours for years. Tell us what you mean by equity.
Well, when I talk about equity, it is different. Most people conflate equality and equity. So when you look at those who have been disproportionately impacted over time in areas of education or lack of resources, equity allows us to provide resources at rates that can make up the difference to really, really close that gap of disparities that we see. And so we know that in certain areas, we should be contributing more resources in those areas that have been either underfunded or just avoided. They did not have access to opportunity. And that's that equity component. But a lot of times, Mike, people are conflating when you say DEI or equity, you know, they're conflating people that are qualified or unqualified, or you're giving people something or you're taking from others. And that's not the purpose at all.
May not be the purpose, but I think that's how Trump sees it.
Yeah, but just because he sees it that way doesn't make him right.
But he's in charge. So if he's removed diversity, equity, inclusion from the federal government, and if he has said, and he has said it, I believe, that anything that's funding those initiatives will be not funded anymore, and you're sitting here talking about equity, and that includes helping public schools, do you worry that some of the funding that comes from the federal government will be cut off because of that thrust?
Well, I think we've got to be smart about how we attack it. These are the circumstances that we're dealt with. This is the administration. They have their policies. We've got to do everything we can to maintain the funding to be able to support exactly what we're talking about. And so there's going to have to be different ways that we look at achieving the same results. You know, one of the things for me, I'm not as hung up on, I do think language matters. Mm-hmm. I do, and I don't want to run from it, but I don't want it to matter so much that it adversely impacts the people that I'm trying to help. And so if I've got to call it something else or find a different approach to achieve the same outcome, I'm willing to consider that and most likely do that.
When we come back, there was actually movement yesterday on the Charlotte Transit plan. You thought it was stuck in traffic forever, but there was actually movement in Raleigh on this. We're going to talk about what that means in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Mark Jarrell is with us. He's the chair of the Mecklenburg County Commission, and we're talking about all things that face the county and all the things that they fund and where the money comes from and the need for more. And lo and behold, the transit plan, which we've been talking about now, I think, since 1918. I can't remember the exact year. But the transit plan finally had some movement yesterday in Raleigh. And in fact, the legislative leaders, Phil Berger and the new Speaker of the House, Destin Hall, were in Charlotte. Give me the lowdown. What happened yesterday?
Well, they paid us a visit, which was, you know, which was nice. I think it's always good when leadership comes down they were hosted by the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance and really just had a question and answer session just gave us their vision for the state, how they viewed our region.
How do they view our region?
Well, you know what? That's interesting. I think they understand that it's an economic engine. We did not drill down on specifics. It was more at a high level, but mm-hmm. they know that we're an economic engine. I think we heard some positive comments about the legislation that was filed yesterday with respect to transit. And I think the signal was it's going to be tough, but, you know, we feel like it is a win or a step forward to have it filed.
This has really been complicated. I follow this because I have to. If I didn't have to, I don't think I would. But I follow it, and I can't follow it. So this is a problem. So Vicki Sawyer, the Republican representative from, I think, North Mecklenburg County, introduced this legislation, which is required for us to get to start the process of getting a one-cent sales tax referendum on the November ballot. This piece of legislation does what?
Well, I mean, one, it's going to allow us to put the measure on the ballot.
Okay.
That's exactly
so
what it's going to do.
That happened yesterday. We've been talking about this, Mark, for 10 years. So what happened yesterday that made that was the day? Why didn't it happen 6 months ago? Why didn't it happen last year? What made yesterday the magic day?
Well, I'll tell you, we've got to give a lot of credit to people that have been working hard on this issue. The mayors from the towns and the city have been working really hard. The managers from the towns and the city working extremely hard on this piece of legislation. Of course, our manager, Dina, was tip of the spear. Commissioner Altman is all things transit as well. But I think just trying to get a consensus locally, and then also when you expand it out and understand those who are in power that have to allow this, they're the ones we had to, I believe we really had to make it palatable to produce a product that would be palatable to them.
To the legislature.
Essentially, yes.
Who will never ride.
And meet the needs, and meet the needs of the community. So it's a both and.
The legislature's dictating a lot of this because the plan, there are still four plans on the table. They still haven't decided on which plan they want to go for. And those plans were devised because legislative leaders said our plan, our original plan, was too train-centric, and it needed to be more road-centric. So now I think it's 40% goes to trains, 40% goes to roads, 20% go to buses, no matter which plan you look at. All the plans have the Red Line train from downtown to Davidson. Then some of the plans have various different expansions of the Blue Line, various different permutations of the Silver Line, some with trains, some without, some with rapid bus transit and expansion of the streetcar. All the plans are slightly different. People, I think, you tell me if I'm wrong, want the trains. But the legislature doesn't want the trains, so we're going to give them a hybrid. In an inflationary economy, when eggs are $5 a carton and you're going to raise property taxes again, are people going to say yes in November to a 1 cent sales tax for transit that doesn't give them, unless you live in Davidson, the trains?
I believe when people understand, well, first off, let's start here. The options that are presented are based on how we can actually, what we can fund, how we can pay for this. And so they're looking at, with the amount of money that's coming in, these are the options. Here's what we could do. When we look at where we're headed, by 2050, our population is going to double. We need to move. You've heard me talk about the most vulnerable a bunch of times this morning. We've got to be able to move people to opportunity. They have got to be able to get around in this community in different ways. It cannot just be everyone driving and we have just massive congestion. So I think when people weigh that, I don't think they're going to look at it as a tax. I think people will look at this to a large extent as an investment that the community has to make.
Our WFAE's Steve Harrison has been covering transit for a very long time, and he keeps pointing out that when they put these plans up or when they talk about what they'd like to do, they never run ridership estimates. That's not part of the equation. It's where these things should be and what drives development and what the new shiny toy is. Do we know what people are likely to do? Are they likely to ride bus rapid transit? The people in Matthews are incredibly opposed to this, at least the leadership is. Do we know that if we put a plan out there and we put the 1 cent sales tax in place and we do what the plan says, one of the four plans says, that people will actually use it?
Well, I don't think you can definitively say that we know, but I suspect.
Well, we know that people right. We know people use the blue line, and we also know that the blue line is an economic development engine. It has been,
right.
and will continue right. to be. And we know that had the silver line been fully realized, it too would probably result in the same thing. We know that the red line may make sense, but although Steve has said he's run the numbers on this, and he says with the toll lanes on I-77, you'll actually get from Davidson to downtown quicker than the train. So maybe more expensive than the train, but you'd get there quicker. So where's the breaking point? How do we know that people will use it? If they want trains and we're not giving them trains.
I think people have to move. I think people are concerned about being able to move in our community. People are trying to move and get to their jobs. People are trying to get to centers of education. They are trying to access services. And so we have so many people in the community that have to and rely on public transportation. And we've got to expand those options for them. We don't have a choice.
The city has skin in the game. They bought the tracks.
Yes, they did.
They bought the Red Line tracks from Norfolk Southern to run the Red Line train to Davidson. There is no plan B. So if this doesn't pass, we have tracks. I guess we can have a picnic on them or something. What does the county have skin in the game too?
Well, we have skin in the game to the extent that, I mean, we did not buy buy the Red Line tracks, but you know, we have skin in the game to the extent that our residents have to have mobility options. And we really are going to have to continue to look at this in a way that is forward thinking. It's really, Mike, I think some folks are missing it, right? It's not really about 2025. It's about 2045
right.
and 2055
right.
that we really have to consider. And so I think we feel like we have a huge stake in this as it relates to being able to provide these mobility options for our residents.
I mean, it's kind of perverse because we live here. And right. we experience the need on a daily basis. We don't just know about it intellectually or read about it or hear about it. We know it. We live it. The people in Raleigh who are telling us, no, you can't have that plan because it's too train-centric, don't live here, and they really don't understand it. And they think of us as legend would have it, the great state of Mecklenburg.
I think I've heard that before.
Yeah. So part of the problem is that. Part of the problem is that we live in a blue area. Everybody on the county commission is a Democrat. All but two members of the Charlotte City Council are Democrats. I don't think there are any other Republicans in high office in Mecklenburg County. I don't think. I could be wrong. But we have an all-Republican legislature. They control everything. And they want to control more. They're taking powers away from the executive branch, which is run by a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
Does that put this region at a disadvantage?
It does. You know, we have to keep that in mind as we are implementing initiatives, as we are thinking about how to meet our needs. I mean, that definitely is a factor. I from my perspective, for sure. There's a different, in certain areas, there's a different philosophical approach to governance. There's a different difference in ideological approach. We start from different ends of the spectrum a lot of times. But that doesn't mean, you know, listen, we're here to solve problems. That doesn't yeah. mean that there shouldn't be a meeting in the middle. That doesn't mean just because I'm starting from a different side of the spectrum that I'm right. I need to hear what I don't know, and I need to understand that. But I also need willing partners to understand what they may not know, because you said it perfectly. We're here. We live it every day.
There was a book back in the 80s or 90s called Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. And when I think about the political divide, it seems worse than that between Republicans and Democrats, because you come at it from different angles.
We do.
With completely And I was going to say different points of view, but they're absolutely diametrically opposed in many cases. And there's very little room for compromise, because to compromise is weakness. And it's hard to run a democracy when you won't compromise with the other side, when you have to be right. Given everything that's going on, and you're in politics, is there a way out? Is there a crack in the door somewhere?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, at the local level, I think most of us look at it as we're in public service. Federal level, they play a lot of politics. We are so proximate to people, Mike, that the politics really, for us, go out the door. You know, and so, you know, there are certain things that are non-negotiable, that are non-starters. There, you know, when we're talking about helping people, looking after our most vulnerable, funding education, those are going to be non-starters. I don't think that those should be compromise points. But do we allow the 10 or 20% that are non-negotiable to stop us from working on the 80? Mm. We need to work on those tough issues and come to some level of understanding. But we should do this work where there are some things that are going to be non-negotiable.
So I have about 4 minutes left, and we were talking before the show about how things take so long to get. I was talking before about how things take so long to get done, the transit plan being one of them. The other is Brooklyn Village. And at the beginning of the month, the commission heard a proposal from the developer of this long-delayed Brooklyn Village redevelopment project. They are now offering to make the apartments in the initial phase of this development affordable housing, as opposed to market rate. And you seemed to like that proposal. Others on the commission appeared to be frustrated with the length of time it's going to take for ground to be broken. What has taken so long for this to come together? It's taken what? A decade?
Almost a decade.
Exactly. So what has taken so long for this developer to start?
Well, that's a $1 million question that the community's been asking. The commissioners are asking that as well. So the frustration that you saw from some of my colleagues was deserved. I mean, it was justified. One, it's been these interlocal agreements and, you know, the legal stuff and, you know, the purchasing of the land. I mean,
who owns the land?
The Peebles Corporation or whatever their entity is. It was county land.
It was county land.
Yeah.
So what's the deal? The county wants this to happen, right?
The county and the city want it to happen.
Okay.
It's a partnership.
So what has taken so long to come to terms on selling these tracts of land to the developer that you chose to do the work?
Well, I can't tell you all of the intricacies that were the holdups initially. Mm-hmm. You know, lawyers are involved and, you know, there are, you know, real elements to making sure that the people of the community get the right deal. And so there had to be interlocal agreements between the city and the county and you know, also the negotiations with Peebles. Some of us, when we first got on the board, we were questioning whether that we could get more affordable housing units as well. Then economic conditions took over, changed the game, and really sort of was a huge impediment. When we received that update, we were told that they were possibly going to wait until 2027 to see what the economic conditions are, which for me was just not an option. You need to come back to this community and let us know exactly what can we do. Waiting until 2027, over a decade, is not acceptable. Now, at least give us an option to consider whether we do it or not. That's something completely different. And I was, when you think about 250 units, affordable housing units in Uptown Charlotte, high opportunity area, I think it's an opportunity that we have to explore.
How do the economics of that work for the Peebles Corporation? They're buying all this land at a certain rate. They've decided to make these affordable units and not market rate units. How does that work? Most developers would say no.
Well, it works with investments coming back from the public. That's the only way you can make it work. I mean, they'll get some incentives. They'll apply for incentives from the feds, but it'll also consist of local additional investments.
So I have about 30 seconds left. Are you confident that this latest permutation is going to happen and that ground will be broken when they say it's going to be broken? And when will that be?
I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll be vertical going in 2027.
Lucky for you, we're out of time because I wanted to talk about some other things, including the silver tsunami, which evidently I'm part of.
I will be.
You're a spring chicken. Mark Jarrell is the chair of the Mecklenburg County Commission. His first solo appearance here as the chair. Thank you for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.